Let us not be hypocrites. It is so easy to condemn our medical profession, and rightly so. Of all the people in the world who should understand physiology and ecology, they should. But they do not. But once in a great while, we awaken to a degree of surprise. What we're going to share with you this evening is from a lecture that was given 5 weeks ago by an amazing doctor. The lecture dealt with constructive alternatives, specifically dealing with, well, Big Pharma, who I'm not a fan of. Dr. Abramson begins his lecture by stating, "I developed a serious cardiac arrhythmia, ventricular tachycardia, 7 years ago. It worsened over the past summer and early fall, and over the past 6 weeks I've had several ambulance rides and hospitalizations. And my experience through this illustrates the good side as well as the bad side of medicine today," he begins. Good evening. Welcome to, I don't know what we want to call it, your health, your choice. But we deal with these issues on a Wednesday, at least we try to. It's difficult to do after what we did on the air last night. I, up until an hour ago, was still receiving commentary on that program. Apparently, I woke a few people up. And I hope we do the same thing tonight. Hope we wake you up as relates to health issues, medicinal issues, etc. The doctor continues by talking about the good side. On the good side, he said, "I was fortunate to have the attention of two world-class doctors who spent 6 hours, one going inside my heart, the other coming through my chest wall to the outside of my heart, to map electrically the aberrant signals in my heart and to ablate them. And since then, I've not had a problem. But on the bad side, 2 days after the procedure, I was in the intensive care unit," he said, "when a cardiologist came by on rounds, or as he advocates, a wider use of cholesterol-lowering statin medications than our author does. And the intensive care cardiologist began to cite the literature about why he should be taking more cholesterol-lowering medicine than he already was. The doctor continues, he said, "I asked if he had read the studies underlying that literature, and of course he had. And Abramson then asked him if he understood that the end point of many of those studies wasn't really appropriate to determine the benefit of statins. And the cardiologist acknowledged that there was some debate about that. And finally, he was asked if he was aware that when peer-reviewed articles are published in medical journals, even the most reputable medical journals, the peer reviewers don't have access to the actual data from the clinical trials being reviewed. And the visiting cardiologist answered somewhat meekly that, yes, he was aware of that." In other words, he was aware that his recommendation that his patient, our author, increase his use of statin drugs was based entirely on incompletely vetted, commercially sponsored, and largely commercially influenced medical journal articles. All of which gets to the heart of the problem of the commercial takeover of the medical knowledge that doctors believe in and implement. I have a doctor who's an ardent listener to this program. Now, sometimes he doesn't get to listen to it live because he's working. But some of the things we're going to talk about here tonight will hit Dr. Fred. Not in a bad way. because he and I have talked about this stuff. He understands the things we're talking about right now. And so our author says, but before continuing the thought, he says, let me step back and explain why I begin from the assumption that U.S. healthcare is on the wrong track. An easy way to gauge the health of a country and to compare the health of a country with that of other countries is to look at average life expectancy. And if you look at a chart comparing average life expectancy in the U.S. with the average life expectancy of 11 other wealthy countries from 1980 to 2021, you will find that in 1980, the U.S. was just about equal with those other countries. But as the years have progressed since then, life expectancy in the U.S. has fallen further and further behind. Until 2014, our life expectancy was going up, but we were losing ground to the populations of other advanced countries. Now, by 2019, prior to COVID, life expectancy in the U.S. had fallen relative to that in other countries so much that 500,000 Americans were dying each year in excess of the death rates of the citizens of those other nations. Now, to exclude poverty as a factor in these numbers, a study looked at the health of privileged Americans, specifically white citizens living in counties that are in the top 1% and the top 5% in terms of income. And this high-income population had better health outcomes than other U.S. citizens, but it still had worse outcomes than the average citizens of the other developed countries in such areas as infant and maternal mortality, colon cancer, childhood acute lymphocytic leukemia, and acute myocardial infarction. And so now you begin to combine all of this with the fact that we in the U.S. are paying an enormous excess over those other countries on health care. In the U.S., we spend an average of $12,914 per person per year on health care, whereas that figure in the other comparable countries is less than half that figure, $6,125. That means that we're paying $6,800 more per person. And if you multiply that by 334 million Americans, we are spending in excess of $2.3 trillion a year on health care, and we are getting poorer results, which means simply that our health care system is broken and needs fixing. Prior to leaving office in 1961, President Eisenhower famously warned the nation about what he called the military-industrial complex. Our author suggests that we now have a medical-industrial complex that is sucking Americans' wealth away from the other things that will make us healthier and, in fact, create better lives for the American people. So ask yourself this question. What ought to be the primary goal of American healthcare? To my mind, it's to maintain and improve individual and population health most effectively and efficiently. And if that is correct, there are two critical questions that we all need to ask. Why are we failing so miserably to achieve this goal? And secondly, why are doctors and other healthcare professionals willing to go along with this dysfunctional system? Now, one of the fundamental reasons for the disparity between the health of Americans and the health of people in other wealthy developed countries is that our medical industrial complex has taken control over what doctors and the public accept as medical knowledge. And this is something that has evolved over time. Back in 1981, when our speaker, our author, was finishing his medical residency and starting a 2-year fellowship, which is when he learned his research skills. At that time, his colleagues And he would spend hours dissecting the articles in medical journals, and commercial bias was never an issue. But 1981 turned out to be a pivot point. Derek Bok, the president of Harvard University, said in Harvard Magazine that year that the university's reliance on industry funding for research was causing an uneasy sense that programs to exploit, in other words, make money from, technological development are likely to confuse the university's central commitment to the pursuit of knowledge. And he explained that because grants from the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation were declining, scientific researchers were turning to commercial sources for funding. And so along the same lines, a 1982 article in the journal Science, the academic industrial complex, pointed out that universities that have been pursuing knowledge for its social and scientific value had been suddenly drawn into the marketplace and were pursuing knowledge for commercial value. You understand the meaning of that? Money. We today have grown accustomed to an environment where it is normal for professors at medical schools to have commercial relationships, but it wasn't always that way. And it doesn't, nor it shouldn't, have to be that way in the future. A second factor in the evolution that our author is describing was the passage by Congress in 1980 of the University and Small Business Patent Procedures Act, also known as the Bayh-Dole Act, B-A-Y-H hyphen Dole Act. When Japanese cars entered U.S. markets in the late 70s, it was widely believed that the Japanese government was supporting the development of those imports in order to help Japanese car manufacturers compete against their U.S. counterparts. Many thought that the same loss of competitive edge was happening in science. Research taking place at universities wasn't being properly commercialized because the universities had no financial incentive. Well, the Bayh-Dole Act aimed to remedy that by allowing universities and other nonprofit research institutions to commercialize discoveries made by their scientists while conducting federally funded research by retaining any profits, including profits from patents on pharmaceuticals. And with that, universities became players in the marketplace, or the game, as it were, and were absorbed into the medical industrial complex. Now, I know that some of what we're sharing with you may be somewhat boring to some of you. We may have already lost some people. I'm not concerned about it. They're going to miss the best part of what this doctor is sharing with us. It is profound. It answers questions that I have been asking over the last year and a half, given the battles that I'm fighting with all the damn medicine that they're sticking down my throat. Our doctor continues. Hang on a second. By saying that the first and most obvious result of all of this had to do with who was sponsoring and controlling medical research. In 1991, 80% of pharmaceutical research was taking place in university medical centers, and it was conducted, analyzed, and published by independent academic researchers. But by 2004, only 26% of the pharmaceutical industry's research was taking place in universities. The other 74% was being done by for-profit research companies. And these companies might hire medical centers to provide research help, but overall, control of the research had moved from the academic centers to the pharmaceutical industry. And this was a radical change. A 2005 article in the New England Journal of Medicine noted that 80% of clinical trial agreements allowed drug companies to own the data produced by the research. Now, in our doctor's mind, data from a clinical trial, excluding, of course, manufacturing techniques and genuinely proprietary information, is a public good because doctors are going to use that data to make decisions about how to treat their patients. But the drug companies don't see it that way, my friends. The litigation involving Pfizer, although Pfizer is no different than other drug companies in this respect, internal Pfizer documents stated in stark language that Pfizer-sponsored studies belong to Pfizer, not to any individual, and that the, quote, purpose of data from these studies is to support, directly or indirectly, marketing of our product. Marketing of our product? End of quote. Not to ensure that the drugs will make people healthier or improve a quality of life, or to ensure that they will do no harm, but just to support the company's marketing. These internal documents go on to specify some of the ways the data is used for marketing. One is through publications for field force use. Translated into plain English, this means the drug companies purchase reprints of medical journal articles, have their drug representatives hand them out to doctors so that the doctors will prescribe their drugs. Now, that would be a perfectly fine thing to do if the journal articles underwent independent peer review. With independent analysis of the accuracy and the completeness of the research and data provided in the medical journals, well, we could trust them. But as things currently stand, we can't. The New England Journal of Medicine survey that he cited before contained two other interesting findings of note. That in 24% of the clinical trial agreements, the sponsor, meaning the drug company, may include its own statistical analysis in manuscripts, in other words, the journal articles. And even more outrageously, 50% of the clinical trial agreements allow the sponsor to, quote, write up the results for publication, and the investigators may review the manuscript and suggest revisions. In other words, 50% of the contracts that academic medical centers make with drug companies allow those companies to ghostwrite the articles. And the researchers who are the named authors of the articles have the right to suggest revisions, but not to make actual corrections or edits. My friends, this is not academic freedom, nor is it an arrangement in which medical science is going to serve the interest of the American people. So, related to all of this, our author once asked an editor of one of the world's most respected medical journals why journals don't simply require that the drug companies submit their extensive internal clinical study report and data while redacting proprietary information. And the editor responded without missing a beat, that would be a death spiral for the journal. And what he was saying is that he understands the problem, but that the medical journals need to publish the major clinical trials to maintain their prestige and continue to sell reprints back to the drug companies. As an aside, by the way, the sale of reprints is a big deal. In 2005, The Lancet, one of the world's most prestigious journals, made 41% of its income just from selling reprints. But you see, it is irresponsible for medical journals not to require transparency from the drug companies. But it makes perfect sense when we understand that their financial dependence on those companies. In summary, the biomedical market is not like Adam Smith's basic market in the 1700s. It's not a market where people shop for their bread and their meat and their beer and where they can directly assess the quality of the information, the quality of the product, and whether the price is fair or not. Biomedical products are not directly experienced goods like bread and meat and beer. They are what economists call credence goods. Goods that cannot be evaluated directly by the purchaser. Rather, consumers must rely on the evaluation of so-called experts. And with prescription drugs, the manufacturers have a monopoly on said information. I think that I shared with you a while ago one of my heart medicines was renewed in January. Actually, it was a replacement for one that I was on. And it was insane what we had to go through. I mean, they wanted $1,400 for a one-month prescription and back and forth. And interesting enough, this particular drug is now advertised on television, but I've seen it offered for a number of different reasons, for diabetes, for heart disease, for something. In fact, the heart disease, I've never even seen an ad for that. But I see this product. Well, eventually, my doctor got the prescription taken care of, and my insurance picked it up. It cost me $130-some-odd for a three-month supply. Well, getting down near the end of 3 months, and I got a prescription for the replacement for it, same exact drug. All of a sudden, it was $400-some-odd. And unfortunately, the pharmacy that I picked it up from was the pharmacy that I used to go to. They didn't get an order for it. What happened is that they just assumed it was ready for renewal, and they posted it and called me up and, hey, we got your drug ready, blah, 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 blah. I went down there, picked it up, gagged when it was $400-some. 5 days later, my heart doctor gave me the replacement prescription, back to the $100-some-odd figure. It's insane. This is all continual manipulation. So now let's talk about the issue of basically what I just brought up, the excess cost. There are three main factors. One is that the U.S. is the only wealthy developed country that has no formal mechanism of price negotiation. The second is that because most consumers are insured, they pay only a small part of the price. So high prices don't provide market discipline. And the third important factor is that, well, as a country, we're perhaps too mesmerized by the idea of biomedical innovation. Well, that is interesting because I'm certainly insured. I pay only a small part of the price, with the exception of two drugs. Well, yeah, $400 certainly isn't, you know, $2,800 or $3,700 or whatever. But that's not the point. How can I pick up a prescription in January and pay $130-some-odd and 3 months later it's $400-some? I ain't mesmerized. So let's talk a little bit about this third factor. Historian Jill Lepore has written that innovation might make the world a better place, or it might not. Innovation, she goes on to say, is not necessarily concerned with goodness, but often with novelty and speed and profit. Oh, it is so certain that in the biomedical area, too many innovations we are being sold today are not being properly evaluated in terms of their true value for the public. We in this country are spending 96% of our biomedical research money on medical drugs and devices, and only 4% on how to make the population healthier, how to deliver health care more efficiently and effectively. Put another way, the U.S. spends $116 billion on researching new drugs and devices. What? That's insane. $116 billion on researching new drugs and devices, which only comprises 13% of the total healthcare costs, but only $5 billion on research. concerning the remaining 87% of healthcare costs. Now, why is that? Because the drug company's job is to maximize the money they return to their investors. And the highest return on research investment is not going to be from studying and promoting healthy diets and healthy lifestyles. Well, my friends, the money is in selling drugs and devices, all of which leads to a tremendous epidemiological imbalance in the information coming down to doctors. And even when new drugs get approved, only one out of four is actually materially better than the previously available and far less expensive therapies. Germany's Institute for Quality and Efficiency in Healthcare, an independent agency under contract to Germany's Minister of Health, found the 216 new drugs entering the German market between 2011 and 2017, only 54 of them were of major or considerable benefit. 37 were evaluated to be of minor, less, or non-quantifiable benefit. And there was no proof of added benefit for 125 of the rest of the drugs. But in this country, because we don't have a formal mechanism of evaluating new products, doctors don't know which product out of every four is worth prescribing. They're visited by marketers and given medical journal articles supporting the use of all the drugs, and they're denied the knowledge they need to act as learned intermediaries. And, of course, I've shared with you the story in the years gone by when I went to a doctor I used to go to. I was the first patient of the day, and as I sat there waiting to get called in, two of these hot babes walked in, short skirts, well-endowed in every respect. One was blonde, one was brunette. And they were representatives of the pharmaceutical company there to get him set up with the latest round of whatever kind of drugs they were trying to peddle him. Well, he went and met with them, and I met my appointment now 45 minutes later. Gee, no wonder. This, to me, is an unbelievable sign of what we're facing in this nation. Our doctor, and we're going to take a very brief break. It's not a commercial break, though. It's my dance. Never mind. In his recent book, when we come back, we're going to talk about something called Trulicity. It is a diabetes drug that reduces the risk of heart disease. Wait a minute. A diabetes drug that reduces the risk of heart disease. What's my drug cost? What's it called? It's in the other room. But son of a gun, it's being advertised on TV as something for heart disease and diabetes. How many other drugs do the same thing? Well, this particular one has been heavily advertised on television, heavily marketed to doctors. But it wasn't publicized or shared with doctors. It was Trulicity's NNT, which stands for Number Needed to Treat. Well, I'm going for a quick dance. When we come back, I'm going to describe to you what NNT stands for. Stick around. I got to go see Kim.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Kim back in the day when she was Kim before she had the plastic surgery so many years later. NNT. Number needed to treat. NNT tells you how many patients have to be treated and for how long. For one patient to benefit from a drug, in the case of Trulicity, it turned out that you have to treat 327 people for approximately 3 years in order to prevent one non-fatal heart event. And treating just those 327 people over that time period would cost the public $2.7 million. Wouldn't knowing these numbers make a difference to a doctor deciding whether to prescribe said drug? Or maybe to a patient deciding whether to request the drug? And all of this is leaving aside the possible negative side effects, the number needed to harm for each of them, which clinical trials often fail to monitor and more often fail to report in journal articles. Well, you got to dance with Kim. I went to the other room to grab my questionable prescription. It's a product called Farxiga. Okay. It's spelled F-A-R-X-I-G-A. And depending upon what kind of television you may happen to watch, we don't have cable TV. We dropped it years ago. But there is a law that requires that if you have satellite in your area, repeaters, and in the case of where we live, we've got mountains that have them, they must provide certain things for absolutely free. Absolutely free. And so we pick up a various different group of stations that, you know, the average cable guy would never listen to, but I don't care. So Farxiga, we see advertised along with Lord knows what else. Don't forget your health insurance, your burial insurance, all this kind of stuff is advertised on a continual basis. The number needed to harm. And so Farxiga is being advertised for heart, for liver, for Lord knows what else. What is this? A wonder drug? So we've got all these brand name drugs being developed. All of them are marketed heavily, regardless of their effectiveness. The drug companies that own the patents are monopolies. How high are these brand name drugs being priced? In comparative terms, they cost 3.5 times more in this country than in any other wealthy developed nation. But the most shocking numbers have to do with the rate of increase in prices. In 2008, the average annual price of a new drug in this country was $2,115. By 2021, the annual average price of a new drug had risen to $180,000. Think about that. In 2022, 1 year later, the average annual price was up to $257,000. Pharmaceutical companies don't make cures, ladies and gentlemen. They make customers. And what does that do? It makes them billions upon billions of dollars. Big Pharma is comprised of for-profit companies. The job of for-profit companies is to maximize the returns to their investors. Uh-oh. Accusing drug companies of being greedy is like accusing zebras of having too many stripes. They're doing their job. We're not going to change them. So it's our job, not only doctors, but the American people as a whole, to insist on guardrails to ensure that the pharmaceutical industry serves rather than harms public health. What is needed is quite clear. First, we need to ensure that the evidence base of medicine is accurate and complete, which requires independent, transparent peer review. Secondly, we need to implement health technology assessments so that we and our doctors know which drugs and devices are the most effective. And thirdly, the price of brand name drugs must be controlled. This is not rocket science. Why doesn't it happen? Largely because the greatest bipartisan agreement among our political leaders is that it is fine for them to accept large contributions from drug companies. Oh, come on, people. Huge amounts of money flow about equally to both the Democrats and the Republicans. This is why any meaningful reform will require the formation of a coalition of Americans to demand action. The plea that our author would make is that people on the conservative side who have an aversion to government and people on the progressive side who have an aversion to free markets come together with open minds to find a middle way to solve the problem of declining health and spiraling costs. We need to transcend our ideologies to think of the good for our country and its people on this issue. Neither the people who tend to the Republican side alone nor the people who tend to the Democratic side alone will ever be able to break up the medical industrial complex that has a stranglehold on American healthcare. Instead of focusing on our disagreements, it would be nice if we could all focus on what we do agree about. Namely, that it would be better if Americans were healthier and didn't spend over twice as much money, much of it with little or no benefit, by the way, on healthcare, as citizens of other wealthy countries. Oliver Wendell Holmes said in 1869, "The state of medicine is an index of the civilization of an age and country, one of the best, perhaps, by which it can be judged." John Abramson concludes by saying, "Medical science is a wonderful gift, but we have to use that gift wisely so that it serves the American people by providing the best and the most efficient care. We cannot allow it to be held hostage by the medical industrial complex." John Abramson, doctor, served as a family physician for 22 years, was twice voted best doctor in his area by readers of the local newspapers, three times selected by his peers as one of a handful of best family practitioners in Massachusetts. He's been on the faculty at Harvard Medical School for 16 years, where he taught primary care and currently teaches healthcare policy. He's an interesting man. It is interesting to read of a doctor who is challenging and questioning what's going on within the system. Now, having shared all of this with you just before going on the air, about 20 minutes beforehand, I finished publishing. And by the way, that article is published on drkelly.net. I've noticed a couple little tiny errors I've got to go fix in. It is, in effect, the title for tonight's program, America's Broken Healthcare, Diagnosis and Prescription. I would strongly urge you share it, maybe even with your doctor. Why not? Maybe your doctor will begin to raise his eyebrows and question some of the decisions that they've been making. But then again, maybe your doctor's on the taking edge. So, having prepared this thing and making a decision to do this for the program tonight, I came across another interesting article. I've never been a fan of Bernie Sanders. There are some things that I've begun to see in Bernie Sanders that are really interesting, raising my interest in him. He is grilling and challenging Big Pharma. And he's doing it over exactly what we've talked about tonight, over this years of the deadly price gouging. Sanders stated recently that we want to know why there are Americans who are dying or are becoming much sicker than they should because they cannot afford the medicine they need. When Sanders, I don't know if it was today or last Wednesday, paid his respects to the victims of insulin price gouging in front of the big pharma CEOs who are responsible. And he reiterated the need to make all life-saving prescription drugs affordable. Sanders, of course, is an independent from Vermont. He's the chair of the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. And he opened the panel's hearing by acknowledging the many Americans who have needlessly lost their lives because of the unaffordability of insulin, and the thousands who wound up in ERs and hospitals suffering from diabetic ketoacidosis, a very serious medical condition as a result of rationing their insulin. This is a problem that is unique to the United States, according to Sanders, which is interesting because that's very much a follow-up to the article we've just shared with you. This is a problem that is unique to the United States. Diabetes, a disease which can wreak havoc on organs and eyesight and limbs if left unmanaged. Diabetes affects more than 37 million U.S. adults and is the country's eighth leading cause of death. That according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And although it costs less than $10 to produce a vial of insulin required to treat diabetes, uninsured patients in this country pay nearly $300 per vial of the century-old drug because Eli Lilly and Company, Novo Nordisk and Sanofi, the three pharmaceutical corporations that control 90% of the nation's lucrative insulin market, charge excessive prices with little resistance from federal lawmakers. And as Sanders recently noted, such corporate profiteering, a problem compounded by the widespread lack of coverage into the nation's for-profit healthcare system, forces many people to skip doses, with unfortunately deadly consequences. Recent studies found that 1.3 million people in the U.S. ration insulin, including an estimated 1 in 4 people with type 1 diabetes. People with no insurance are the most likely to do so, followed by those with private insurance. Well, ahead of the hearing, Sanders released a video featuring diabetes patients sharing their struggles to afford insulin in this country. That video will be available on drkelly.info within about 20, 25 minutes. Imagine just three countries having worldwide market dominance over such necessities as air and water. Those words from Steve Knievel, an advocate with the Public Citizens Access to Medicines program, stated last Wednesday in a statement. He said, "This is what people with diabetes face with insulin." Addressing the CEOs of the three aforementioned firms during the hearing, Sanders outlined how each has jacked up prices in recent decades. My friends, I'm going to tell you right now, this is going to shock you. Eli Lilly increased the price of Humalog 34 times since 1996 from $21 to $275. That's a 1,200% increase. The same exact product. No changes at all. The only reason for the huge increase in price during that period was that there was no legislation to stop them. In America, the drug companies can charge any price they damn well please. But it's not just Eli Lilly. Novo Nordisk increased the price of Novolog 28 times from $40 in 2001 to $289. That's a 625% increase. Oh, but it was much, much less than Eli Lilly, so they can't be bad guys, right? Of course, then there's Sanofi, a company that increased the price of Lantus 28 times from $35 in 2001 to $292, a 730% increase. In each and every instance, it's the same exact product that rose astronomically. And let's be clear, said Sanders. This is a problem that is unique to the United States. In France, 20 years ago, the cost of Lantus was $40. Today, it's only $24. Wait a minute. In France, you can buy Lantus, the same exact product that we buy in this country, for $24? And yet we're paying $292 or $289 or $275? Why is it that we take it in the butt with all this stuff? Well, Sanders has famously accompanied Americans with diabetes on a 2-mile trip from Detroit, Michigan to Windsor, Ontario. In Canada, people can purchase the exact same insulin product for 1/10 of the price that they would pay in the U.S. We cannot rely on limited price concessions from insulin corporations to ensure this essential resource is accessible and fairly priced for Americans who need it. Also in attendance of last Wednesday's hearing with the leaders of the CVS Health, Express Scripts, and Optum Rx, three major pharmacy benefit managers. Sanders took them to task, noting that as insulin manufacturers continue to increase prices, PBMs, or pharmacy benefit managers, sign secret deals to increase their profits by putting insulin products on their formularies, not with the lowest list price, but the ones that gave PBMs the most generous rebates. And thanks to sustained public pressure and fresh policy changes, namely the Inflation Reduction Act's provision, which limited Medicare beneficiaries' insulin co-payments to $35 a month, Eli Lilly, Novo, Nordisk, and Sanofi have all recently pledged to significantly lower the list prices for some of their insulin products. As Sanders has explained, Eli Lilly announced it would reduce the price of Humalog by 70% later this year, from $275 down to $83. Eli Lilly also decreased the price of its generic Humalog to $25 per vial. Novo Nordisk announced that they're going to reduce their price by 75% beginning next year, from $289 down to $72. And Sanofi is going to reduce their price of Lantus by 78% beginning next year, from $292 down to $64. Well, Sanders thanked the three companies for taking what he called an important step forward, but he stressed that we must make sure that these price reductions go into effect so that every American with diabetes gets the insulin they need at an affordable price, vowing to hold a hearing early next year to make certain that all of this happens. Knievel, meanwhile, said that we cannot rely on limited price concessions from insulin corporations to ensure this essential resource is accessible and fairly priced for Americans who need it, regardless of their insurance status or age. And his message was echoed by one Margarita Jorge, head of Lower Drug Prices Now. The thing that tends to begin to bother me is that all of this is based on greed, my friends. We spoke about it in the last piece we share about the politicians that are on the take because they continue to support all of this nonsense. The politicians are buying so many lies and so much BS, and they're too stupid and ignorant to realize it. I thought that the Congress, the Senate, the House, the presidency, etc., were there to represent America. We, the people. Not America, we, the corporation. Corporatocracy. And yet that seems to be what it's all about. These people are getting elected and reelected because of the amount of money that is pumped into their pockets because they support the drug companies. They support the oil companies. They support the medical communities to give them whatever the hell they damn well please. This is unbelievable. When is any of this going to end? Do you think the medical profession, do you think the pharmaceuticals give a damn about you and I, the patient, the person on the street? The only time they give a damn about it is one of their own family members kicks the bucket. Sanders has made it clear that the unaffordability of insulin is part of a much broader crisis. And he proceeded to ask, saying, if Eli Lilly can lower the price of Humalog by 70%, why is it still charging the American people about $200,000 for Cyramza to treat stomach cancer, a drug that can be purchased in Germany for $54,000? If Novo Nordisk can lower the price of Novolog by 75%, why is it still charging Americans with diabetes $12,000 for a product that is purchased in Canada for $2,000? If Sanofi can reduce the price of Lantus by 78%, why is it still charging cancer patients in America over $200,000 for Caprelsa, a drug that can be purchased in Japan for $37,000? Sanders stated that lowering the cost of insulin is only one part of what we must accomplish. The committee is determined to end the outrage in which Americans pay by far the highest prices in the world for virtually every brand name prescription drug on the market, whether it's a drug for cancer, heart disease, asthma, or whatever. We want to know why there are Americans who are dying, who are becoming much sicker than they should because they can't afford the medicine they need. We've got to ask, how does it happen that nearly half of all new drugs cost over $150,000? How does it happen that cancer drugs, which in some cases cost just a few dollars to manufacture, are selling in the market for over $100,000? Americans die. They get sicker than they should. And they go bankrupt because they cannot afford the outrageous cost of prescription drugs. But the drug companies and the PBMs make huge profits. This has got to change. The story goes on, but we've made the point. Congress, not greedy corporations, trying to redeem their tarnished reputations. Congress should be leading the way on reforms that put patients ahead of pharmaceutical profits. It's about damn time. There are some people that are standing up. They're speaking out. And you know what? That's what you need to do. That's what I need to continue to do. The heading on this article is Sanders grills Big Pharma CEOs over years of deadly price gouging. And although he's concentrating predominantly on insulin, it's used as the basis for the direction he's trying to take. Sanders is becoming an interesting bird to watch. He's getting on some things that interest the living hell out of me. Should interest you guys. I don't know how much you've gotten out of this. It is a basis. It is the strength of what's going on. The insanity of the medical community. I hope you've gotten something out of it. Thanks for being patient with me this hour. Good Lord willing, I'll see you tomorrow. But in the interim, with glass lifted on high, I say, to health with you. Good night. It brings back a night of tropical splendor. It brings back a memory evergreen. I'm with you once more under the stars and down by the shore. Orchestras playing, and even the palms seem to be swaying when they begin the beginning.
again is past all endeavor, except when that tune clutches my heart. Divine, what rapture serene, till clouds came along to disperse the joys we had tasted. And now when I hear people curse the chance that was wasted, I know but too well what they mean.
Standing 6'4", weighing in 245 pounds of crime-fighting, political science-analyzing brawn, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Patrick Slattery.
So, Mike, get off this anti-cicada agenda.
I'm a born-again traditional Christian, and my favorite possessions are right here on my nightstand. That would be the King James Bible and my .357 revolver.
I'd rather be ruled by Chinamen than Jews.
Cool it with the anti-Semitic remarks, right?
Just because you steal an election and terminate the republic doesn't mean you terminate the people in the republic, because we're still here.
I'm not taking the vaccine. Fuck you, Bill Gates.
There was a way forward still on January 6th. What needed to be done is to object to every single state.
The COVID-19 virus was the setup. The vaccine could very well be a bioweapon.
The Patrick and Jeremy Show. Tuesday at 9 Central and Wednesday at 1 Central.
You're listening to Real Talk Radio. Only on the Republic Broadcasting Network.